continuing our study of the Psalms. All right, so we'll start with our summary statement for this psalm. Psalm 91 praises God's covenant faithfulness that protects and delivers. Those who take refuge in Him. I'll go over that one more time. Psalm 91 praises God's covenant faithfulness that protects and delivers those who take refuge in Him. A simple outline for the psalm would be two parts. Verses 1 to 13, God's trustworthiness. Verses 14 to 16, God's spoken promises. Go over that one more time. So verses 1 to 13, God's trustworthiness. Verses 14 to 16, God's spoken promises. Okay, so we'll go to our observations of Psalm 91. Psalm 91, as you can see, has no superscription, no heading. And in fact, the book four Psalms, there's only three of them that do have a superscription. Psalm 90 that we just looked at, and Psalm 103, I think, and maybe 101. There's only three of them that have superscriptions. So there's no superscription for this psalm. There's no indication of authorship in the text of the psalm. So there have been various authors that have been suggested, and it seems like every anonymous psalm that we have always has somebody that suggests David is the author. So David is probably one of the most common that is suggested for this, and that may have to do with the fact that the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament that was done a couple hundred years before Christ was born, the Septuagint actually added to this psalm of David. And as far as I have found, there's no historical support for them to do so. So that's probably why many suggest that David possibly wrote this. Could also be Solomon, some have suggested. Some have suggested some others. It is placed right after Psalm 90, and Psalm 90 was written by Moses, and it has very strong connections with Psalm number 90, as well as connections to Deuteronomy chapter 32 and other passages in the Pentateuch. So it has generally been thought that an anonymous psalm that is placed immediately after a superscripted psalm is an indication of the same authorship. And that idea would then make this a psalm of Moses. And that thought is actually, there actually are a few good reasons to think that, Moses was the author, or certainly that it's possible. You have textual and thematic connections between Psalm 90 and Psalm 91 and the wilderness exile of Israel. You also have references to like the names of God that are used here. You have Elyon, which is translated Most High, which is a very common name, more so common back in the Pentateuch than it is in later writings of the Old Testament. So you have some of the language that would seem to apply to that older time as well. And also the fact that there's no occasion given for this psalm, so there's no superscription, so there's no occasion there, and there's no specific occasion in the text of the psalm. But when you look at the psalm, you realize that the psalm uses a desert wilderness exile motif. So What I mean by that is it uses different aspects that would allude to that. So you have the thousands falling, the thousands or ten thousands that are falling at your side. You have outbreaks of pestilence that would be common again among a band of journeying people. You have long journey in a rough terrain that is depicted. You have different types of lions, which is interesting. You have the need for shelter. You also have living in tents, as the word is used there in the psalm for tent. You also have demonic and angelic presence in this psalm, which is something commonly associated with barren desert wilderness type settings. So, in other words, when you look at Psalm 90, if it wasn't written by Moses along with, I mean, Psalm 91, if Psalm 91 wasn't written by Moses along with Psalm 90 in the wilderness wanderings, then it seems like it was deliberately written to accompany and complement Psalm number 90, because it uses a lot of the same language, a lot of the same references, a lot of the same allusions. In both, it is a complement to Psalm number 90. Psalm number 90 is sort of one side of view of the exile, and Psalm 91 is another side or view of the exile. So again, can I say, conclusively, oh well, Moses wrote this psalm? And I don't think we can. Although I do think it certainly is possible. But if Moses didn't write it, then it does seem that it was deliberately authored to complement Psalm number 90 and also to have this reference to the wilderness wanderings. Psalm 91 is a psalm that's difficult to categorize. Now, I've talked about the categories of psalms, and again, there's nothing in the Bible that categorizes psalms this way, so I'm not saying that's a biblical categorization. I'm just saying it's a way of grouping different psalms. When you start seeing sort of patterns that are repeated, whether in form or in content, like with lament psalms, it becomes obvious that you can group those together in a category. So Psalm 91 is one of those kind of psalms that just doesn't really fit the pattern of any of the common psalm categories. I would say maybe mostly you could say that it's a praise psalm, because it does have a long list of praiseworthy acts and attributes of God, and praise psalms is kind of general anyway, so it seems reasonable to put it there. It's not really. Some have pointed out that it has certain features of lament psalms, and it does, but it certainly doesn't overall fit the form of a lament. In fact, it's almost what I would call an anti-lament. In a lament psalm, typically, you have some sort of a crisis, that has been a long, drawn-out crisis. And so the lament psalms are praying to God and crying out, how long is this going to go on? How long before you're going to deliver? And that is not the question here in Psalm 91. It was a question in Psalm 90, but in Psalm 91, it's not a question of how long, but rather it's looking at that crisis and the faithfulness of God to endure and persevere through it. So I don't really categorize it as a lament psalm. I would call it a messianic psalm, and we'll talk about that more when we get to the interpretation part. It's not usually classified among the messianic psalms, but I do believe there is justifiable reason to do so. All right, so now, I've already mentioned some of these connections, but Psalm 91 does share very strong connections with Psalm 90 that comes before it here in Book 4. So you have this concept of God as refuge or as secure dwelling place, and that's obviously important in both psalms. You have this wilderness motif that I've already mentioned. You have the endurance and the overcoming of the faithful. And you have a number of terms that will be shared between them. And you also have strong connections with Deuteronomy 32, which is something that also Psalm 90 has. So in Deuteronomy 32, you have the imagery of taking refuge in God, Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 2, 4, 37. In Deuteronomy 32, you also have the imagery of the mother eagle or this some large wild bird of that type spreading wings over her young. Now, that's Deuteronomy 32:11. And that's also an important image here in Psalm 91. You have pestilences and plagues, and essentially in Psalm 91, you have the promise to be delivered from those things, and in Deuteronomy 32, you have the promise of those things coming upon the wicked rebellious. So Deuteronomy 32, verse 24. And also another interesting connection is that Psalm 91 and Deuteronomy 32 are the only two places in the Bible where there's a combined use of dragon and venomous snake together. Deuteronomy 32, 33. And again, it's the only two places in the Bible where this happens. Here in Psalm 91 and there in Deuteronomy chapter number 32. So, further connections with the wilderness exile also exist through the use of the terms of covenant blessings and or cursings. So in places like Leviticus chapter 26 and Deuteronomy 28, you've got these lists of blessings that if they're faithful, if they keep covenant with Yahweh and they're faithful, they enter into the land, all these blessings are going to come on them. But if they're not faithful and if they disobey and they rebel against God's word and they break his covenant, then all these curses are going to come upon them, ultimately culminating in them being exiled from the land. So you have mention of these, and you have a connection here with Psalm 91. You have the mention of the fear here in verse 5 and in Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 6. The idea of 1,000 and 10,000 falling here in verse 7 and Leviticus chapter 26, verses 7 and 8. References to dwelling place and such here in verse 9, Leviticus 26, verse 11. Diseases here in verse 10. Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 43 and 59, and also the mention of wild beasts, and obviously the danger of wild beasts here in verse 13 and there in Leviticus chapter 26, verses 6 and 22. So the poetic features of Psalm 91, I wouldn't say that it is quite as poetically constructed as Psalm number 90, but certainly does have some of that. Obviously, Psalm 91 uses this desert, wilderness, exile motif, and that's what we talked about. So it uses all these different aspects of desert, wilderness, exile, and it uses a lot of imagery. God as a mother bird protecting her young. You have military imagery, references to armor and weapons. You have dangers that are presented through all kinds of images, whether that would be from disease outbreaks or whether that would be from wild animals or invading enemies and so on. So you got a lot of imagery there. And then also, the way that this psalm is set up, you know, God is refuge is sort of this theme that runs through this psalm. And it also provides an important contrast because you have God as secure refuge, and then you have man or the covenant faithful that are in the midst of constant difficulty and danger, which again goes along with the desert wilderness exile. All right, so let's work our way through this psalm. 16 verses. I'll go ahead and read it. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him will I trust. Surely He shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover thee with His feathers, and under His wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. Thou shalt not be afraid for terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee. Only with thine eyes shall thou behold and see the reward of the wicked. Because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation, there shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways. They shall bear thee up in their hands, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone. Thou shalt tread upon the lion and adder. The young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample under feet. Because he hath set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high, because he hath known my name. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. So we start here in verses 1 to 4 that open up the psalm, and we get this expression of the faithfulness of God to the one who trusts in him. Now, the psalmist describes one who shelters in Yahweh, dwelling in the secret place of the Most High, and so on. And he's using these terms and imagery, Most High and Almighty. He's using these terms and imagery of God that depicts God at like a high mountain with a secret, secure place of hiding for his faithful to dwell. The use of refuge refers to a shelter, the use of fortress to a defensed stronghold, and the reference to trust, in him will I trust, also refers to taking refuge. And these are recurring terms in the Psalms. We've seen them a number of times, and what you get here in Psalm 91 is just a pile of them. They're just multiplied in this particular psalm, but we've seen them throughout the Psalms, all the way back to Psalm 2 and verse number 12, and Psalm 18 verses 1 and 2, and Psalm 25 and verse 1, and then again, we've just seen these repeatedly used throughout the psalm. These are terms used to refer to God as sometimes a high tower, sometimes a rock, sometimes a dwelling place, all of these different ways, and they all give the idea of being a place of protection, being a place of defense, being a stronghold, a fortification, a place that cannot be invaded by the enemy or broken through. And then we get this description, or following this description of God as a protective refuge, we get into the beginning of these various dangers, and these dangers are featured throughout the bulk of this psalm. The snare of the fowler is obviously, that's a hidden trap. So a hunter uses a trap and he hides it, he conceals it in order to capture his prey. And so that would describe secret and hidden dangers. We might think of walking through and think of a place with tripwires or buried landmines or something like that. There's these hidden dangers that we're always on edge looking out for as we are making our way. Pestilences describe plagues or diseases. And in other words, these are dangers that work within. Once these things are contracted, they attack the body and the body systems from within and do their damage. And we get multiple images and terms of God's covenant protection. And of course, here in verse 4, a very important one, the metaphor of God as a mother eagle, or again, some other type of large wild bird like that, protecting her young, stretching out the feathers of the wings and sheltering and protecting her young from any attack, any sort of predatory attack. Now, this imagery actually originates back in the Pentateuch. This, as with God as this bird gathering his covenant people under his wings, like a bird would its young. This actually originates back in the Pentateuch, but it's also repeated in places like Ruth chapter 2 and verse number 12. It's referred to. And a number of times in the Psalms. So Psalm 17:8, Psalm 36:7, Psalm 57:1, Psalm 63:7, Psalm 68:13. So we have a number of references to this imagery of God as a protective mother bird with her young. These references to shield and buckler, obviously this is contributing to the military imagery. The shield would in fact be a large shield that one can hide behind. The buckler, I would refer to the armament, something that would be worn, some type of armor. And then we get to verses 5 to 8. Now, in verses 5 to 8 particularly, we get these references that have so many connections with the wilderness exile of Israel. But here we notice that there's time being marked. So we have references to night, to day, to darkness, and to noonday. And of course, this is a way of sort of poetically expressing at all times and at all circumstances. So each time has its own particular dangers. The dangers of the noonday are of one type, dangers of the darkness are of another type, and so on. Now, the night and the darkness references can also be language that is depicting spiritual enemies, or what we might refer to as demonic activity and attack. And this is, again, often associated with wild, barren, wilderness-type places as sort of being places where one would be more prone to those types of attacks. There are different types of dangers that are also mentioned that cover just sort of a wide range of threats, the night terror, the arrows, the pestilence, and so on. So in other words, all types of dangers at all times and in all circumstances essentially are what's being alluded to and being covered. We have this reference to 1,000 falling and 10,000 falling at the side and at the right hand and so on. And these are describing times of mass death, like that you are part of a large group that is sojourning through a very rough and barren environment, and that there are times of attack or times of plague or pestilence outbreak, disease outbreak, where a large number of people are dying at a time. And of course, this very much would coincide with the plagues in Egypt that came when Israel was protected, though there were many that were falling at the right hand. And then, of course, later in their wilderness wanderings, there were different times when the plagues would come or the serpents came or whatever that it was, or maybe even during battle, that many of them would fall at one time. And so there's a promise here in verse number 8 to see the repayment or the judgment of the wicked. And so this is a promise that is a promise to be kept and not to be judged along with the wicked. In other words, God is promising here that he's going to make a difference. He's going to make a distinction between his covenant people, those who are faithful, those who have taken refuge in him, and those who are the wicked, those who are the rebellious, those who are the unrighteous. So in other words, those that have taken refuge in him will not be treated the same way as those who have not, those who have defied him, those who disobey and rebel against him. When we look at verses 9 to 13 now, we get this strengthening of these promises. This word for dwelling in verse number 10, that there will be not any plague come nigh thy dwelling. That's actually a word for tent, and it's oftentimes translated tent, and that's what it means, a tent that's sort of a temporary nomadic type shelter. And so we see this contrast between the Lord being a refuge and a habitation, and then a tent in the wilderness. So these are assurances that are being given because of the one who has trusted in God, the one who has made him his refuge. In other words, the tent is not really a very secure dwelling place. It might be a shelter and a shade. It might keep out the wind mostly. It might keep out the rain. It might shade from the sun. So there's some protection that is given by a tent, but it's very temporary in nature, and it's very limited in nature. But the refuge and the habitation of God is seen as a fully secure dwelling place. And we're getting that play of that contrast between the two. The mention of angels that comes in verse number 11, as you continue on, is a reference to messengers. It's much like the Hebrew word, that are used here are synonymous. And essentially they mean messengers, and they don't necessarily mean a spirit being, although here I do believe the reference is to spirit beings that we think of as angels when we use that word. And so their presence and their help is set against the demonic activity that was alluded to earlier, the terrors by night and the darkness and all of those sort of things. Well, evil spirits then would represent another kind of danger in the wilderness. So you think about being in the wilderness and you think about being in danger from the sun, being in danger from not having enough water, not having enough shade, being in danger from storms that might come up, being in danger from the roughness of the terrain, you know, the bruising your foot against the rock and so on, and then in dangers from all the wild beasts, in dangers from perhaps marauding bands that would be in the area, or enemy tribes or warrior tribes or whatever that might be in the area. You start thinking about all these dangers that would exist to you in that situation. Well, then again, then these evil spirits represent another type of real danger. And so the angels are mentioned sort of as a counter, and their work is a counter to that. Now, the keeping in all of thy ways there in verse number 11, the word for ways is the common word that's used in the wisdom literature, particularly in Proverbs, also in Ecclesiastes some, for way of life. It's that word direct. It means a road or a path, literally is what it means. And here it is referring to the normal course of life lived. So as you are going on your ways, you are beset by all these dangers, and the presence of these angels are actually there as a help and as a protection and as a deliverance from various dangers in the normal course of life. And then we have this reference to these different wild animals. We have lion and adder, adder being obviously a venomous snake. And then we have young lion, and then we have dragon. So the word for dragon actually has been used before in the Psalms. It's a word that refers to could be some sort of a sea monster or some sort of a serpent. There's actually two different words that are used for lion here, and what I understand is that in the ancient Hebrew there were actually four different words that referred to lions, and they referred to four different types of lions. But also that we don't really know what those distinctions are today in those words. So two words are used here. One is translated young lion, the other translated lion. But we really don't know for sure what the significance of those distinctions would be. But nevertheless, altogether they represent these dangers from wild animals in remote and barren places, and the protection that is given from them. Now, as you come to the second part, and this is verses 14 to 16, and this will be the second part of the psalm, the ending part, you'll notice that there's a shift. And in fact, in this psalm, you have the writer of the psalm, and that you see in the first person. You have the one who is taking refuge in Yahweh, and he's referred to in the third person, and then you have actually the response of God. So you actually have verses 14 to 16, which give us a divine oracle. This is direct speech from God. And essentially, it is his answer to the one who has taken refuge in him. And so God's answer concerns the faithful one that's taken refuge in him. And what we get in these verses, we just get this multiplication of promises. It's like just a sort of a shower of these promises that come forth in very rapid succession. So God promises to deliver, to set on high, to answer, to be with, to deliver, to honor, or to rescue, to honor, to satisfy, and to show his salvation. So again, we get these just rapid, repeated promises of God that he's going to do for the one that has taken refuge in him. We also in these verses get a good description of what it means to take refuge in God. What does it mean to really trust in God? Well, if we look at these verses, we can discern at least three different things that it means. One is that he sets his love on the Lord. And this is the same terminology that is used in Deuteronomy 7:7 and Deuteronomy 10:5, where Moses talks about how God set his love on Israel. Well, here we see that is used the other way. God speaking says, he has set his love upon me. So taking refuge, trusting in God, means setting your love upon God. Another thing that it means, at the end of verse 14, has known my name. And of course, the word for known there is a word that indicates a real relationship and a close relationship. He set his love upon the Lord. He has known his name. He has had close relationship with him. And then the third one is he has called upon the Lord. He's called upon the Lord. He's called upon the name of the Lord. So all of these things indicate again that there's a very real close covenant relationship. This is what it means to take refuge in God. It means to love, to know, and to call upon the Lord. And then we also have reference here that in God speaking, saying that he's going to answer. He is heard and he's going to answer. Well, being heard and answering has been a repeated theme throughout the Psalms, and it's a mark of one who is trusting in God, one who has taken refuge in him, one that is in covenant relationship with him. We've also seen it appear in numerous places where it becomes a vindication of the righteous sufferer. So you have the one who is in some sort of danger, in some sort of trouble, in some sort of distress. They've called upon the Lord. The Lord has heard, and the Lord has answered and delivered the one that called upon him. So again, it's a vindication of the righteous sufferer. We saw it very common in the laments of David, particularly in the earlier parts of the Psalms, where we have these laments where David is suffering unjustly in all these various ways, and he's calling out to God, and God will hear and will answer him. And essentially, his calls is he's righteous in his calls. He's vindicated. His faith and his trust in God is also vindicated because God will ultimately deliver. And all these troubles that have surrounded him are not going to destroy him. The word for trouble that is used here is a common word for tribulation and distress. The covenant faithful are delivered from. This runs throughout the Psalms, Psalm 25, verse 22, Psalm 31, verse 7, Psalm 34, verse 6 and 17, Psalm 37 and verse 9, Psalm 46, verse 1, Psalm 50 and verse 15, Psalm 54, verse 7, Psalm 71, verse 20, Psalm 77, verse 2, 78, verse 49, Psalm 81, verse 7, and Psalm 86, verse 7. So you can see that's been a continual theme throughout the Psalms. All right, so let's go to interpretation. So Psalm 91 teaches the covenant faithfulness of God and God alone as secure protective refuge for those who trust in him through dangers. And that is the dominant theme of this particular psalm. So God as a refuge, then, again, it's the major theme. It repeats throughout this psalm. All of the various wilderness motifs delivering that theme. Everything is sort of in service to that in this psalm. So there are various dangers that are presented throughout this psalm. The dangers of men, the dangers of beasts, the dangers of disease, even the dangers from demons. And all these are listed, showing us the necessity of such shelter. So the one who trusts in God is actually in this desert place and surrounded by all of these dangers, and it's necessary to have a protective shelter. And it also shows us the impossibility of man being able to shelter himself. Can you build a successful shelter against all of these dangers? No, you can't. And it's impossible for man to do so. And this is why we need the shelter of God. Psalm 91 teaches the necessity of Israel in their wilderness wandering and in their present exile to trust in Yahweh that he will save them and deliver them from all their tribulations. And you see, this exile theme is not just something that happened back after the Exodus. It's something that also occurred as we saw at the throughout Book 3. Jerusalem is destroyed. The temple is destroyed. The Davidic throne and crown is down in the dust. The people are scattered from off of the land and scattered among the nations. And that is what continues to this day and will continue until the end of this age. And so Psalm 91 is very relevant. And what happened back there in the exile and the wilderness wanderings is very relevant even today. It continues to be. And if you think about the promises that are made here, so there's promises of safe, secure dwelling, promises of safety from enemies, promises of safety from wild beasts, promises of safety from diseases, and promises even from demons. And these are combined with promises of long life and prosperity and satisfaction. Well, these are what was promised as the blessings for keeping the old covenant. You go back to Leviticus 26 again, Deuteronomy 28, really throughout Deuteronomy, especially it runs throughout that book. These are the promises that were made. This is what you will get, essentially, if you keep the covenant. But they missed out on those blessings because of their inability to keep the old covenant. Of course, that is prophesied in Leviticus and Deuteronomy as well. These are also blessings, though, if you keep on reading the Bible, these are also blessings that they will receive through the new covenant as the Abrahamic and the Davidic covenants are fulfilled in the millennial kingdom. So safe dwelling, safety from enemies, safety from wild beasts, safety from disease, prosperity where the works of their hands are blessed, long life and satisfaction and joy and rejoicing on the earth. These are promises of the millennial kingdom. So if you look at Leviticus and Deuteronomy, these are also prophesied about the latter days when God returns to them and gathers them and restores them. And in places like Isaiah chapter 65 and chapter 66, these are the blessings of the millennial kingdom. Now, this psalm then is not a promise that they will not see these dangers and these sufferings and these troubles and these distresses in this age, but rather it's that they will be delivered from them. So the messianic hope of Psalm 91 is seen very clearly from Satan's use of Psalm 90 verses 11 and 12 to tempt Jesus in the wilderness in Matthew chapter 4 verse 6 and in Luke chapter 4 verses 10 and 11. And in fact, this is another point that commends a Mosaic authorship, because if indeed Psalm 91 was written by Moses, then every scripture quoted in the wilderness temptation would have all been written by Moses, if indeed Psalm 91 was written by him. So this psalm, you step back and look at it, this psalm is written about one who trusts in Yahweh, one who has taken refuge in him, one who will be delivered from danger, and one who will be victorious over his enemies, even to the stepping on the serpent and the dragon, which is the promised seed of the woman. So obviously then, this psalm, as I said, I believe, is messianic. And Jesus, Satan, used this psalm and applied it to Jesus. And Jesus rebuked him, not for applying it to Jesus, but Jesus rebuked him for misusing this psalm. So he rebuked and he corrects Satan's misuse of the psalm, as Satan used it to try to force Jesus to tempt God and to display or illustrate or manifest that he was God's son. Well, Jesus understood this psalm to be a promise to be kept through suffering and even death, to be delivered victoriously. So Jesus then is also the prime example of this psalm for everyone who trusts in God and the salvation that each one will see through the midst of the dangers of life on this earth in this age. All right, let's go to application. I have two of these. Number one, understanding Psalm 91 helps us understand what it means to trust in God. What does it mean to take refuge in God? Well, to take shelter in Him from all the dangers that threaten us in this life. In other words, what is our defense? What is our hope? What is it that we resort to? Now, obviously, we take reasonable means and steps and measures for our own safety in this life. We anticipate certain dangers and we respond to them in a certain way. But ultimately, where is your confidence really placed? And these dangers that threaten us in this life, for those who trust in the Lord, those are just mortal dangers. Jesus said, don't fear only those that can kill the body. And after that, there's nothing else they can do to you. But fear Him that can destroy both body and soul in hell. So where is our ultimate confidence? Is it in the defenses that we construct? Is it in our ability? Is it in the army of our nation? Where is our ultimate confidence for our safety and our eternal life? Also, to trust in God's to love God supremely and to endure through distresses into His and unto His kingdom. Number two, understanding Psalm 91 also helps us understand that these promises are not promises that we won't see trouble. In other words, if you read Psalm 91 carefully, you realize that that's there. These are not promises that you're not going to see trouble. Oh, well, if you just trust in God, you're not going to see any troubles. That's not what this psalm is promising. That certainly is not what the rest of the Bible promises. Rather, that these are promises for God's deliverance of us through all of these troubles. So whether we suffer in this way or whether we suffer in that way or our life, you know, ends peacefully in our sleep or ends at a martyr's stake or ends in a prison or ends in any other number of ways, the promises means that these distresses, these dangers cannot separate us from God's love. So it's just like what Paul writes in Romans chapter 8, verses 31 to 39. What shall we then say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? He that spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? It is God that justifieth. Who is he that condemneth? It is Christ that died, yea, rather that is risen again, who is even at the right hand of God, who also maketh intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? As it is written, for thy sake we are killed all the day long, we are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Nay, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. And that is also what Psalm 91 is telling us. All right.